There's a lot of convergence here today, with a lot of people converging on the same sort of themes to offer some homage to Bob. And not unlike those, I've converged on some same things. And I have some comments to add a bit of flavor to that mix. And I want to focus, as always, on Bob's contributions to insect ecology and students. But I want to first think about his contribution to students. It strikes me, when I look at the career paths and career success of people who've been in Bob's lab or associated in any way, that it's stunning and it's humbling to me. Shown here in this picture are three generations. We could put about 500 people in this picture, but here are three generations of people who benefited from that interaction. Myself, two students of mine who have self gone on to do good things, and my nipper. And for those of you with discerning eyes, you can probably guess that after a day of butterfly collecting, this picture was snapped after 5 p.m. Typically, my son's eyes work perfectly fine. I want to comment on Bob's use of language, because you could not be associated with him and not forever be changed in how you use language in two very different ways that I want to offer homage to. And the first is what I think of as the language of science. Bob's writings, in my mind, deserve to be read. They deserve to be read by many people because they are exquisite examples of the art of presentation. His writing is direct, incisive, complete, and persuasive. I read his ecology papers and I go like, damn. And so too do many people. By the way, there were 31 of them, with some more still to come. And he approached his talks with the same way, of course, and we're well aware of that. He also used language, what I like to think of as the language of life. And Bob forever changed my use of language. He created an entire lexicon, as many people know. And that lexicon was remarkably useful. And it was useful, for example, when one wanted to point out the hilarity of the sad state of human communication, or point out the absurdity of interactions between trophic levels, particularly within academics, if you were dealing with administration and things like that. We put together a compendium, as many of you know, after his death, and there are several hundred terms, and the most I can't talk about. On a serious note, I think of Bob's contribution in a sense of themes, and I, like everyone else, did a lot of soul searching, and there are at least five things, and probably a lot more, that bear comment. Bob exhibited extraordinary commitment in two ways. An academic commitment. For example, shown on the left here, are taken from Bob's CV, are areas that Bob worked in. He didn't just work in these areas. He worked in these areas in a way that set the tone for the field to develop, in some cases, for years and years and years. Okay? That comes with extreme commitment. He also had a terrific commitment to his students, which is pretty clear. And he had a commitment to study systems. Many times we had chats about, well, maybe he should move away from that boring Spartina system. Nothing further from the truth. His applying of that system is testimony to his unparalleled ability to explore, his tenacity, and his unrivaled ability to extend concepts again and again and again. And finally, we should think about this concept of synthesis. Bob synthesized, particularly in the last part of his writing, which was much more still to come, obviously. Look at the last 15, 20 papers Bob wrote. It's all about synthesis, synthesizing many of these subdisciplines and bringing to bear lots of weight on historical issues. I want to just tackle one topic in a very humble way. I want to think some about Bob's contribution to spatial ecology, and again point out this book, which I don't have a copy of, but George does, and he might give me his. Okay. I, like others, was very influenced by that, and it led me on a career of studying spatial ecology in a plant-insect interaction. And I'm going to talk today about deem formation, a special case in selection and local adaptation. And I just want to point out, for starters, that this sort of system is really no different in some sense than the sort of antagonism that takes place between gene flow and selection, whether we're thinking about species boundaries, host race formation, etc. Deem formation is really a special form of local adaptation, where we can think of spatially discrete interbreeding groups that are somewhat isolated, have specific definable genetic characters, and may be contiguously distributed, but nonetheless exhibit this hallmark feature of local adaptation. If we were to look for evidence of demic adaptation, if we were using neutral genetic markers, we'd pick that up with some signals with genetic substructure, and those would indicate that drift and founder effects have overwhelmed a homogenizing affected gene flow. If we were looking at those traits or trying to finger the traits involved in adaptive differentiation, then clearly we'd be looking for the signal of selection in closely adjacent environments where selection varies dramatically in its direction and intensity. Famously, Edmonds and Alstad pointed this out in 1978, applying this concept to plants, where they suggested that it's the features of plants that can structure the populations of specialized herbivores into these things called demes. So we're looking at a really fine-scale sense of local adaptation. At heart in this issue is a hypothesis, and the hypothesis is very clearly stated. Individuals that mature on a particular plant should outperform individuals from other plants that are transplanted to it, or they should have performance that's higher on the natal plant than they would if they exported themselves to another plant. It turns out that deme formation is a really tough sort of row to hoe. It takes special conditions in order to see this fine-scale local adaptation. It's augmented in systems where dispersal is limited, plants are isolated, insects have short generations relative to their long-lived host plants, and strong selection is evident that is going to parse apart populations. Okay? Some of these are present in the system I'll talk about. In order to have a complete research program, if you will, that explores deme formation, one needs to use a lot of tools. You need to document spatial variation in host quality. That's an ecology task. You need to link herbivore fitness to plant ecology. Quality, that's maybe a little ecological genetics work. So too in exploring the genetic basis of trade-offs between demes. And finally, you might need some molecular work to sort of ply those waters of how does patterns of neutral genetic variation support local adaptation. So given that, we can ask the question, what is the evidence for demic adaptation in Phytophagous insects? And the answer is pretty meager, really. There have been a variety of studies, 15 to 17, I think, at last count, that have looked for this interesting phenomena, and only a few cases of success. Four orders were represented prior to a good bit of work done by a student of mine, Scott Egan, published last year, and we added the Hymenoptera to this. My objectives today are for a single study system to ask a series of questions. I want to ask, what is the spatial nature of variation and abundance in a host-specific gall former? I want to try to link density of herbivores to plant quality. And I then want to test specifically for deme formation, looking at traits that may be adaptive on variable host plants. And I hope that we can do a little armchair biology and put two and three together to get to four and provide some sort of synthetic explanation for the distribution and abundance variation in this particular insect. The study system is a host-specific gall former that lives on live oak. The sexual generation ovipositors into leaves. Galls develop, from which asexuals emerge, gynophores and androphores. They move to the roots. They make galls. Those galls develop during the late winter, early spring. Sexuals emerge, mate, and complete the cycle. Everything I'm going to talk about today has to do with this generation, asexuals depositing onto leaves. Our first objective was simply to describe the extent of spatial variation in population density. And to do that, we took a 4,000-acre block of land owned by our university, and we asked a very simple question. What's the distribution of abundance among trees? So we sampled 100 trees, selected along 13 transects, and we asked, what is the density of gall formers per tree, per meter? And here's a classic example. You can see this in all sorts of systems. Many trees have very few gall formers, and very few have extraordinarily high densities. We define these in the right-hand tail as high-density trees. They average about 60 galls per meter of foliage. And we define those at the left end as low-density trees, clearly an order of magnitude less in density. Notice that these high-density trees in yellow here are widely spaced and relatively infrequent. The little ones, the ones with the black dots, are the ones I'm going to use in the work that I'll talk about. The distances we're talking about here are really measured in fractions of a kilometer up to about a couple kilometers distant. So the evidence will be for strong local differentiation. The hypothesis that we're going to test really first is we simply want to know whether gall former density equates with plant quality. So here's, for example, a high density tree, and it's surrounded by putatively low quality trees that we already know are low density. If we find evidence that density and quality equate, we can start to think of these high density trees as islands of high quality habitat in a Dan Jansen sort of framework. Second hypothesis we want to test is whether performance varies depending on the source of the population. So here we might envision some transplant experiments where we compare fitness of natal populations on their own plant versus transplants and vice versa. And again, if we accept the alternative hypothesis here, then we're looking at fitness trade-offs between alternative plants. The experimental design for this is pretty straightforward. We selected 5 high-density trees, and for each of those high-density trees, we selected one of the low-density neighbors in each of the 4 compass directions, and on each of those, we bagged animals onto previously excluded vegetation. To get at the demic adaptation scale part of this study, we simply reciprocally transplanted animals from natal tree A to novel tree B across a fully replicated set. Okay, so this is the basic design. One experiment that links 2 hypotheses. The design analysis looks like this. Every tree is used as a donor, trees 1 to 6. Every tree is used as a recipient, so trees grow up, or populations grow up on themselves, populations grow up on the alternative high density trees, and all populations are put on their respective 4 near neighbors. The replicates are sufficient to get at what we want, 3 bags per treatment, 5 females per bag. The methods are pretty straightforward. You get a lot of wasps, you made them in a lab, you put them into previously isolated vegetation, you let them do what they do, and you come back later to score the results. We looked at a series of 8 sequential life history features that each one can indicate a density, quality, or demic adaptation evidence. The first is evidence for a percent of initiation, percent of overposition scars that give rise to gall initiation, the number of galls produced, whether galls are abscised or not, the percent, some leaves are shed, the rate of development, final gall size, and percent emergence. There are 2 other features here I need to point out in a little bit more detail. In this system, natural enemies play an enormous role. Shown here is a plot of the probability of emergence as a function of gall size. And in the presence of natural enemies, those galls that don't reach a size of about 5 millimeters or so have no hopes, chance, in hell of producing a gall former. So only when you get to about 5.8 millimeters does the probability of emergence rise to about 5%. In the absence of natural enemies, if you bag plants and exclude them, animals can come out of little teeny tiny galls. Okay? So we have this tree threshold that sort of captures the effects of the host plant early in development. We performed a mixed model linear analysis on a data. The important thing here is that we're testing for density versus quality, and the tree effect will indicate that here. And a non-significant interaction suggests that we get uniform reaction against all 5 trees. I'm going to define a 9th variable, and we found that we needed this variable because when we checked our bags, we found that we had a large number of replicates in which galls failed to establish whatsoever, even though overposition took place in all bags. In fact, we found that 27 out of 60 replicates on neighbor trees, this putative low-quality trees, were of such low quality that galls couldn't be initiated. And moreover, they were clustered on a subset of those trees, so we found 6 of our 20 neighbor trees that were insufficient to promote the development of any galls whatsoever. Here are the basic results, and they come to one conclusion. Low density equates with low quality from the perspective of the gall former. More galls are produced on the natal plant, galls are much larger in size, initiation success is much higher, and the natural enemy threshold, that critical point in the life history where they've got to attain a critical size to avoid natural enemies, is more than 2 times increased on the native host. We used the same sort of analysis for our demic adaptation thing, but here we need to pay attention to the interaction term because finding a significant interaction term can be interpreted as evidence of demic adaptation. Again, we looked at this 9th variable, the ability to produce galls, and what we found, somewhat surprisingly, is a marginal significant effect. When you put gall formers on otherwise terrific trees, and it's a non-natal tree, they have a lower probability of initiating successful galls. A marginal result, but surprising and interesting nonetheless. Here are the main results. We found that there was no difference in the number of galls produced on natal versus novel. All these graphs are organized as natal on the left and novel on the right. So there's no difference in galls produced. There's a whopping difference in the percentage of galls abscised. So there's some sort of uncloaking taking place here. When animals are transported to high quality but novel trees, they're detected perhaps by the tree better. There's a significant increase in gall size on the natal host. And there's an important difference in the probability of emerging in the absence of natural enemies. Okay? The tree threshold differs between the two, and there's an initiation success effect as well, but in the opposite direction that one might expect. OK, Okay? Initiation success is actually lower on the natal plants than the novel. But taken together, these four results to the right here are all strong evidence, I would argue, for local adaptation at the level of between individual trees. We can look at results of demic adaptation two ways, and classically have been looked two ways. In fact, when Larry Hanks and Bob Denno studied this in scale insects, does that mean I have 5 minutes? Yeah, that's excellent. When Bob Denno and Larry Hanks studied part of this for Larry's dissertation, they interpreted their data as I will show down on the bottom, which is typical. Here's a basic result from our study focused in on emergent success. Okay? On the natal tree, emergent success in the absence of enemies is higher than it is on novel trees. That's pretty good evidence. However, you can look at it in a little bit more detail and get some ecology out of it. Shown in this bottom panel is the average emergent success for an animal. We'll focus on this tree. The average emergent success for a population reared on its natal host compared to compared to all other individuals that might have migrated to that host. So think about it as homebodies, those who stay on the plant, versus those who arrive on that plant from other high-quality trees. And in all cases, the immigrants have lower fitness than they do on the natal population reared on itself. You can also turn it around and ask, what are the consequences of leaving the plant? So on average, it pays to stay home. This population on this tree had high performance on its natal host, and if you move it to another, or actually this is the average of all other high quality trees, their fitness typically goes down. But notice this, there's a lesson here. Here's a population that does really poorly on its own self and could do better if it could only find those non-natal trees, the other high quality trees. You might think, well, gee, that suggests there's not evidence for demic adaptation. What it's suggesting is this population does piss poor on its tree and could do better elsewhere, but when you compare how it does on its tree relative to everybody else who may have arrived there, it still outperforms all other members of the population. There are other consequences to variation in gall size, and I thought I'd quickly point this out. In this system, as in many others, female size is correlated with egg number, gall size is correlated with female size, and hence gall size is not surprisingly correlated with egg number. So the size of the gall an individual grows up in influences its potential fecundity. You can see where I'm going. There's a huge role of natural enemies in this system that are perhaps stronger than anything I've talked about to point. If we remove natural enemies from the system and we ask, what is the probability of emergence as a function of gall size on the x-axis, probability of emergence on the y, here's a cubic spline fit to several thousand galls, and what it shows is that when galls reach a size of about 4 millimeters, the probability of emergence jacks up to about 60% and pretty much stays there. In fact, there may actually be some stabilizing selection against large galls. Contrast that to what happens when we factor in natural enemies. The red curve here shows the distribution of galls in nature subjected to parasitism. There's about 30,000 galls under that distribution. The blue line shows for, it's a composite curve based on multiple populations over multiple years, and it shows the probability of emergence in the face of parasitism. Notice that individual galls have to reach about 6 millimeters in size before the probability of avoiding parasitism rises to 5%. So gall size is extraordinarily important in this system. We have a field test of whether or not this holds water. It's a weak test, but one I'd share anyway. In an earlier data set, we measured mean gall size per tree for 15 different trees, not involved in the current study I'm talking about, and we simply scored the number of animals, the probability of emergence. And there's a moderate correlation between gall size and percent emergence. So apparently there's something happening here in the field too with respect to explaining things. I think we can link the results of both of these studies in a simple way and suggest that variation in plant quality facilitates deem formation in the system due to strong local selection. And at the same time, deem formation reinforces spatial variation in density. Imagine a world where animals can migrate from a high-quality plant to a high-quality plant under high gene flow conditions. Now imagine a world where most of the population are low-quality plants that may actually act like sponges absorbing those individuals that are moving from high-quality plants. When individuals move from high-quality plants, they pay a two-part penalty. One, they have lower fitness on low-quality plants. In fact, remember, in almost 30% of the plants we studied, there are no galls. And in 28% of the plants involved in our experiments, no galls were initiated. So I think that there's a set of plants out of nature that are just so poor, they suck up migrating wasps and impede movement of genes and individuals from otherwise high-quality trees. Moreover, if individuals do make it from one high-quality tree to the other, they suffer a cascade of penalties. In conclusion, plants vary in quality. The animal varies in distribution. Quality and density are related. Natal populations outperform novel populations, and we have a direct and indirect effects of host plants on herbivore fitness. I want to end with a homage. Bob Denno has created a phylogeny of academics that is extraordinarily deep and rich. I've made a teeny little contribution to this. These are individuals I'd call like the odd subclade, maybe, that have come from my lab and up. That's just a smattering of students that fit into a much larger dynamic, as you all know. Thanks a whole bunch. So,